Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Wayne Manns. Wayne Manns comes from a musical background but was drawn to the visual arts. Originally from Atlantic City, he has lived and painted in New Mexico, San Francisco, Brazil, and since 2000 in Bloomington, Indiana. Wayne has exhibited at the Sonoma Art Gallery, the African American Art Museum in San Francisco, at Indiana University, and most recently at Gallery North in Bloomington. Welcome to Profiles, Wayne.
Thank you very much, Shauna.
Wayne, tell me a little bit about what drew you to painting.
I always had a proclivity for drawing, had this ability, this sort of natural ability to be able to depict images that I'd see, and horses and little characters. When I was a young boy, I started drawing art from the Archie comic books, replicating the pictures I saw in the comic books that I read. Much later in life, fast-forwarding quite a bit, I met a woman in San Francisco that was a huge lover of the arts. In fact, her father was a painter and a jazz musician, and he had just passed away. And she had his old easels and paints, crusted old paintbrushes, and she encouraged me to go up and try my hand at it. So that was my start, and this was about 1991. I first picked up a paintbrush, but I was just in absolute fear when I looked at this huge easel and this blank canvas, because I never attempted to do anything of that on that kind of scale, and not having knowledge of painting and how to mix paint and mediums and varnishes and so forth, I was really in a kind of a mode of test and try mode. And I wasted a lot of canvas, needless to say.
So did you learn by yourself? Are you self-taught?
I'm a self-taught artist. Yes, okay. I am. Yeah. So I don't have the benefit of academia behind me, or a studio program.
Or someone telling you the proportions between mixing oil paints and what else needs to go in there.
Right. Yeah. So a lot of trial and error on my part. But I think it gave me a tremendous amount of curiosity about overcoming certain obstacles when it comes to painting. There are certain obstacles that are met from the very onset, and from the very onset, you have this two-dimensional surface, this white surface, this two-dimensional canvas
staring at you,
and then you have all these tubes of paint and brushes, and because I'm a figurative painter, I want to try to depict or transform the reality, whatever reality I'm trying to depict on a two-dimensional form. So I'm taking three-dimensional and going to two-dimensional, and therein lies a huge problem. So for me, it was a trial and error from the very beginning, and it's still sort of trial and error today, trying to push and pull the paint to get it to do what I want it to do.
Talk to me a little bit about the musical background that you come out of. I know that jazz was a huge part of your life.
Yeah. Well, firstly, my mother and father both are huge lovers of jazz. My father was a jazz musician who played mostly around the Atlantic City area. I grew up in this very fertile environment. Growing up in Atlantic City, New Jersey, Atlantic City was the queen of resorts at one time, many, many years ago. And it was considered the playground of the world. It's where everybody from New York and Philadelphia and Washington came to vacation. So there was this island, a seven-mile island of Atlantic City, my home, and it was this huge boardwalk that outlined the perimeter of the island. And on this boardwalk were amusement piers, theaters, burlesque houses. As a young boy, I got to go to a lot of these places. Now, burlesque houses, I have to explain a little bit later, but I should probably say that I was in this kind of magical and very fertile environment for people who would come to Atlantic City to kind of hone their skills. I remember going to see the Supremes when I was maybe just a young boy. I remember when the Beatles came to my hometown. I remember Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. And I remember when George Benson, the great jazz guitarist, first came to to play at the Club Harlem. So my introduction to music was first through my family, through my father and my mother. There was always a piano in our home, and the piano was kind of the center of activity in our home. And I looked at my father, and I'd listen to him, and I'd look at all the albums that were scattered around the living room, and I was impacted by all this. I was really quite moved by all this energy that came out of this piano and from the phonograph. We had phonographs back then.
Yeah.
So these sounds and these images just have carried with me to today. So that, in the short, that was my introduction into the music world. But it has sustained me through today. And early on, I took lessons. My father gave me my first lessons.
Play piano or
horn? Yes, I do play piano. And then I got a piano teacher. In the Black community, the church is a very important part of the landscape. And the Black church was important in our community because there was an organ there, there were several pianos. And so when I formed little combos as a young boy, I was able to have rehearsals in the church, in the parish hall. And these rehearsals were just wonderful musical places, venues for us to really kind of work out some of our very amateur musical talents at the time.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is the artist, Wayne Manns. Wayne, you're talking about that music that was so much a rich part of your background, and I've noticed the paintings that I've seen of yours, both on your website and in exhibit, there's a tremendous amount of movement in your painting. And that movement really comes through to me, even in portraiture where you're capturing sort of, you know, someone being still, they're almost ready to move, or they feel to me like they're almost ready to move. Is there a relationship consciously between your musical background and the way you paint that carries movement into it?
Well, I always paint to music, and it's interesting that you ask that because when I've gone back, I think in my investigation, my examining how other painters worked, many of them worked to Kandinsky, worked to music, Picasso worked, Matisse loved jazz, Jackson Pollock, many of the great painters of the 20th century worked with music or had music in mind. I think that music for me being the sort of dominant initial, my induction into the arts was through music. I think that that has carried and has helped me to be a painter. And the reason I say that is that when I begin a piece, I always select a piece of music. I try to select a piece of music that's related to what I'm working on. If I'm working on a period piece, in other words, digging back in the Rolodex of my mind, and I'm working, let's say, a club scene from the 1960s or the 1970s when I was growing up, these clubs that I would frequent, I will play a piece from that period.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of move around. I kind of dance around sometimes when I'm working. So I think that probably unconsciously there's some stuff going on there. But I like to think that being a musician also at some point must translate into what I'm doing, because I think that being a tactile person from early on, that has helped me to express in my painting a kind of lyrical, kind of melodic flow of my line and my form and even my strokes in my painting. So yes, I think it does sort of carry over and bridge over into the painting.
You've also lived lots of different places. You mentioned, of course, Atlantic City, when you weren't painting but more involved in music, but then living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, San Francisco, Brazil, mm-hmm. where you were painting, definitely.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Back to Bloomington, how have the different places that you've lived influenced your work?
Oh, well, let's start with Santa Fe. That's when I really was baptized, if you will, with fine art. I was living in on a small Indian reservation, and I got to meet some of the very famous New Mexican artists. I got to meet R.C. Gorman, Kevin Redstar, Ron Robles, who are three of the biggest in New Mexico, and international figures as well. I got to go to their studios, and I think for me that just opened up this kind of other kind of wonder, where, you know, this place where I saw these tremendously talented people creating these images out of their imaginations. And I saw the paint, and I saw the easels, and I saw the setup, and I was really intrigued by it as a younger person. When I got to San Francisco, I got to see another kind of fine art world, and that was with the museum that I frequented quite a bit, and I got to go to many of the galleries. In fact, I landed a job at a fine art gallery called the San Francisco Art Exchange. Mm-hmm. And this is before I ever touched a brush. So the Santa Fe and the San Francisco experiences were before I ever touched a paintbrush. But I was feeding this thing that I was really not even aware of at the time.
Similar to music. I mean, you were immersed in music and then played. You immersed in art and then began to paint.
Exactly. So then San Francisco gave me this whole other – it gave me a sort of a business idea of art. It gave me an idea from the museum perspective how exhibits are set up and designed, and also commercial art galleries and how art was sold and marketed. So then I landed a job in an art gallery and became the director of a fine art gallery in San Francisco. And then another gallery I directed. And so I was familiar with different aspects of the art world, the creative side, mm-hmm. the marketing side, and the exhibition side. And I think I was hooked. I just didn't have the resources maybe at my disposal.
Or the actual materials.
Or the materials, right. And then I met a woman that I was actually dating at the time, and she encouraged me to start painting. So with her dad's old paint and crusted brushes, I began this arduous task of trying to transfigure or transform these ideas I had in my head and bring them to a two-dimensional surface.
Did you move right into portraiture and representational art, or did you start with doing more kinds of abstract, or did you experiment?
I did some experimentation later on, Shana. Initially, I wanted to do a piece to pay homage to my father. So I started off probably with portraiture and in a very rudiment and very primitive kind of way. And the results were just horrible. I mean, they were absolutely horrible. I believe I still have the painting somewhere rolled up. It's called Ode to My Father. And I was kind of regurgitating up all these feelings. My father had just passed, mm-hmm. and I was coming up with all this emotional stuff that I wanted to express in this work. And it was kind of a montage of his hands in one part, his face in one part of the canvas, aspects of that I remembered about him in other parts. Growing up, the son of this well-known jazz musician. So later on, I did experiment with pointillism and expressionism and kind of a primitivism, if you will. And I think I kind of landed on my own version of just Wayneism.
On Wayneism.
Whatever that may be. We'll leave that for somebody else to define. But yes, I did experiment, and I love all of the styles of work. Even when I think about minimalism, when I studied in the university and I studied, I would take art history classes, and I'd study about Malevich, or I'd study the futurist, and I'd study Severini or Bala or Marianecchi, and I would learn all these different styles and periods and manifestos that went with these particular periods. But, I have this real love for all of Delacroix, Velázquez. I really have this love and thirst and real admiration for all the periods and styles.
You then went to Brazil from San Francisco, right?
I went from San Francisco. I moved to Bloomington.
Okay.
And then I met the woman that I later married, my wife, Valadia. And she invited me to Brazil, and I went. And then went again on another occasion, and then was immersed in this whole Brazilian scene. And she introduced me to painters that were friends of hers. And then I sought after and looked up artists that were living and deceased and visited their studios, painted, did collaborative works in Brazil. So I had a really rich and wonderful time in Brazil. Brazilians are funny because they love to engage, especially foreigners, and they love to learn about what it is you do. And some of them even, you know, who speak English love to talk in English. But the response I got in Brazil was much warmer than anything that I'd received in the U.S. from American painters. And what I mean by that, Shana, is that I meet a painter in Brazil and it's like, come in my home, mm-hmm. paint here. Here are the materials. You know, here's a place where you can sleep. Here's a place for your family. Come in and make yourself at home. And so it was a very warm and welcoming environment for me as a painter. And I got to see what they were doing in Brazil. I got to see the techniques that they were employing and using. And for me, it just opened up a whole nother world of possibilities in the plastic arts.
Did music come into that at all? I mean, were you affected by Brazilian
yes,
rhythms?
Yes.
I mean, I know there's a tie between that music and jazz that you can hear.
Yes.
But how much did that affect your style?
Well, funny that you mention that, because Pixinguinha, who a very famous Brazilian composer, was very good friends with Louis Armstrong. And there's many, many crossovers between jazz and Brazilian music. But yes, music was always a part of the scenario. So when I was in Brazil, I played Brazilian music. And Brazilian music has some real close ties to jazz, but in a different way, because Brazilian music has more, for me and for what I hear more drumming, I hear more rhythmic things.
Syncopation almost,
yeah, more
right?
syncopation.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I would probably say that as well, revisiting this whole idea of music, that the Brazilian music spawned another kind of thing that I wanted to explore in my work, and that was to look at Brazilian culture, not kind of erase what I knew about, kind of like unknowing all the stuff I knew from America. I wanted to kind of unknow all that stuff and start painting a new way. And so to do that, I inoculated myself with Brazilian music. I ate Brazilian food, obviously.
Feijoada.
Yeah, feijoada. arroz and feijão. I'd eat, all the mangas and the things that grew off the trees. And I think my style started to change. It became richer, I believe, in some ways. It became more mature. So I exhibited in Brazil numerous occasions. Even got an invitation by the Museum of Modern Art to come and exhibit, which was quite an honor. I have to say I didn't make the trip, but it was quite the honor to be invited by the museum to do an exhibit I was working on called The Faces of Brazil. And I go around the streets just drawing people mm-hmm. and doing these portraits. So the exhibit that I have currently in Bloomington, the Women of Bloomington, was sort of incubated. That idea was incubated in Brazil with the Faces of Brazil exhibit that I was working on.
As a African-American artist, I know that you've done a lot with depicting history, jazz, and you're painting The Crossing, and we'll talk a little bit more about mm-hmm. that. But as a black person in Brazil, did that African heritage take on a whole different concept to you? And was that part of what you were exploring as well?
Well, that's a complicated question/answer. I guess if you're asking, was I examining some racial things that were going on in Brazil, like I examined racial issues here?
The way that the construct was in Brazil of being black, is that a very different construct than being black in America? And how did that affect your work?
Yeah, I think it is. Brazilians are – there's a couple thoughts about this. Brazilians are, first of all, Brazilians. They're all Brazilians. They have this real high sense of nationality, and nationalism is dominant in their culture. Here we're African American or Japanese American or Italian Americans. We're these kind of hybrids of, you know, we're all transplanted from somewhere else. They have this sense. They don't consider themselves Portuguese Brazilians. They are just Brazilians, and they have this strong identity, this strong sense of who they are. And even though there are racial issues in play in Brazil, and a lot of it has to do with economics and education, it's different. It's a different kind of racial divide, if you will. But there are things that are quite the same. For the most part, I saw the constructs as economics down there, where here I see it as sort of other factors come into play. And not that education and economics don't play here as well, but it's just different. People there, when they're poor, they're very, very poor. And you, in Brazil also, you didn't have the civil rights movement like you had here. You didn't have the kind of abolitionist movement that you had before slavery. Mm-hmm. You didn't have the kind of history that we had after the Emancipation Proclamation. So there are differences, but there are similarities.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Wayne Manns, the painter. Wayne, how does living in Bloomington again affect your painting style and your work? Here you are in the Midwest of America.
In the heartland. I call it, I'm shipwrecked in the middle of a cornfield. and often when people... when I talk to people, I even surprise myself. You know, years ago we say, she blew my mind or that blew my mind. You listen, well, I blow my own mind just with the idea that I'm in the middle of this cornfield called Bloomington. But Bloomington has been a real fertile place for me to work. It's been a real – the community has embraced me. The university has countless paintings of mine that they've acquired. The restaurants and people in the community have been really supportive in what I do. So I think that for me, Bloomington was a stretch initially, coming from San Francisco, which is one of the most lovely and diverse and inspiring communities cities one could live in and in the world, in fact. And then moving to Bloomington, many people ask me, did I need my head examined? But it's been a really good place for me to work, to paint. It's not necessarily always a great place to market my work because there are so many talented people here in Bloomington. You can kind of get lost because you've got the university and it's wonderful painters and sculptors and musicians, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you can have a difficult time, but I've been able to navigate the waters.
Good. You picked a piece of music to share with us, Wayne, by John Coltrane. Could you tell us which piece it is and why you chose it?
Well, I picked a composition called Bessie's Blues by John Coltrane, late John Coltrane. Yeah, it's one of my favorite pieces. It's a hard-driving blues that swings, and when you hear it, you'll concur that it's a driving kind of piece. My grandmother's name was Bessie, and the inspiration for a show called The Women of Bloomington was my grandmother, Bessie Scott. And so I've always liked the tune. I like the title of the tune. I love John Coltrane. He's one of my favorite practitioners of the art of jazz. And it's an inspirational piece for me. It reminds me of home. It makes me feel at home. ¶¶
We've been listening to Bessie's Blues by John Coltrane, and we're back speaking with Wayne Manns. Wayne, Cornel West, one of my favorite writers and scholars, said about you that you are an artist of great brilliance and moral conscience. How does moral conscience play out in your painting?
I think perhaps what Cornel was speaking of, having reviewed some of my works. Incidentally, I should probably make mention that he's a friend of my family's, and he was in my mother's home, and I was sharing some works with him, and I had some paintings with me, and some critical articles that had been written. And he felt that moral conscience, I'm supposing that he thought that, or was thinking that moral conscience had to do with some of the subject matter that I was delving into. And my subject matter has to do with issues that are really, really sensitive for Americans. Issues around race and racial identity and racism and suffering and, you know, and despair, things of that nature. So when I think of that statement of his moral consciousness, that perhaps Cornell was speaking of this willingness to explore things that are kind of tough for us to look at as Americans, because we like to think that all that stuff is behind us. You know, the 60s and the 70s took care of civil rights and human rights issues. But we can see clearly with Katrina that those things have not been taken care of. We can see clearly with the recidivism and the number of blacks who are in prisons today or on the marginal, on the fringes of our society, that things have really not been addressed as we like to think they have. So if you ask Cornell, he'll probably have a whole nother take on it, but that's my take on it. Yeah.
And he's currently professor of African American Studies at Princeton, having previously been at Harvard and one of the most well-respected scholars and also activists.
And a collector of mine, yeah.
Talk a little bit in that context about you actually have two paintings called The Crossing. There's The Crossing and then The Crossing 2.
Two, right.
Could you talk a little bit about what the subject matter is of that and then what took you to painting that?
Okay. Emmanuel Lutz painted a picture of Washington, George Washington crossing the Delaware River, a very dramatic painting of this band of revolutionaries and patriots who were taking this idea of liberation from the British and fighting this war, crossing the Delaware River, going into Trenton, I believe it was, on Christmas Eve. And they were crossing these icy waters. And I remember seeing this as a young boy. I always admired George Washington. I thought he was just a wonderful, wonderful man. I didn't know that he had slaves at the time. I didn't know all the sort of flaws that perhaps existed in his life. But the images are what really affected me as a young person. I remember this image growing up. So I wanted to do something. I'd come back from Brazil or maybe even Europe. I'm not very sure at the time, but I just returned to the U.S. and I wanted to make a statement about jazz musicians and their struggles, because they were revolutionaries as well, and they struggled against the icy waters of racism and bigotry in a market that was not receptive to them at all. So the first crossing is a direct appropriation of Emmanuel Lutz's famous painting of George Washington crossing the Delaware River. And my crossing, or my appropriation of that piece, speaks about another band of revolutionaries that was taking this music to New York City and then to the world. And I peopled the first crossing with a number of characters. Monk, I think, was the general. So Thelonious is standing with his cloak on and his huge hat. Monk used to love to wear these funny hats. And so that's the first cross. And then I needed a rudderman. And I thought, well, who can I get to be my rudderman? And I said, well, at the time I was thinking about David, because I was living here in Bloomington. And I said, well, Dave plays the cello.
David Baker, of course.
David Baker will be my rudderman. And so on the first boat, he's my rudderman. And I went and I met with Dave, and he's been a friend of mine for years, drew him and immersed him into the rudderman's job. And he got quite a kick out of that. The second crossing, Shanna, because the first crossing is housed here at the Neil Marshall Black Cultural Center. It has been acquired for the opening several years ago and hangs there prominently. The second crossing was my desire to have the crossing in my own collection because I love the painting so much. I sort of went through this lamenting and this sort of period of remorse because I love the piece so much. I wanted to have another crossing. So I put different people in it just to give it a different spin. So I have Duke Ellington as the general and Coltrane, who is one of my favorite guys, as we've talked about, is on the front of the boat. And in the rear, the rudderman is Ray Brown, who just passed away a few years ago, who's the bass player. He's the one steering the boat into New York Harbor.
How hard is it to sell a painting? I know, for a writer, they can still hold on to their words. For a musician, right, you can listen to a recording, but you can't see what you've made again once it's gone, I would guess.
Well, it depends on the time of the month. When Vectrin is due and the mortgage is due, it gets easier to sell a painting. But it's a tough let go. Some pieces are much harder to let go of than others. I wish I didn't have to sell any of them. But, yeah, I'm a realist too, Shannon. And so I believe that, in order to continue to grow and to continue to paint, I need to market my work. I need to put my work out there. I need to gain some sort of return on all the energy, all the investment and the resources that it takes to do one piece. So to keep that continuum going, I do need to let go but I think it's time motivated
as well. You started to say before that your most recent exhibition on the women of Bloomington mm-hmm. was inspired by your grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
What led you to do that collection of work and how did you choose your subjects?
Well, the women of Bloomington was inspired in part by my grandmother. The other inspiration was my mother, who's still alive. My grandmother passed in the mid-90s. I wanted to reconnect with the spirit of my grandmother. And I also wanted to investigate the community I lived in. I wanted to see who were the women. Because I know that in my family, women raised me. Mm-hmm. My father was this musician, but he was often not around to do the nurturing. And so my coming of age, to a large degree, had to do with women shaping who I was. And women taught me things like kindness, compassion, responsibility. My mother and grandmother taught me all these very, very important principles. Men taught me other things, how to be cool and this and that and, how to get girls and be, So men taught me the other things in life, but I think women taught me the things that were really, really important and have made me a better person today. So wanting, in the spirit of wanting to investigate this and rekindle this closeness with my grandmother, I decided to talk to women and again, from the Brazil experience, the faces of Brazil, I said, well, why don't I do the women of Bloomington? I had a gallery who had given me a time for the month of October, so I started talking to women, and I talked to one, and she said, well, if you're going to do this exhibit, you've got to talk to so and so and so and so and so and so, and you've got to get her, and her. And then every her, and her I talked to said, well, you've got to get her, and her. And this thing just started snowballing, and it snowballed and then just became this wonderful exploration into women, historical women who are important in big ways and in small ways, but women who make Bloomington the wonderful place it is to live, women who teach us, women who entertain us, women who research and women who provide business services for us. So in actuality, the show should be called Some Women of Bloomington, because there's so many women that I could not include due to time and resources. But I wanted to select ones that I thought were real important for me in my life. And of all the people that I talked to about this, I talked to countless people. They said, well, this woman is very important. She's important. She's really important. And so it wasn't just my idea, but it was a lot of – it was kind of a communal idea on who we all thought would be important to include in the Women of Bloomington.
In addition to reconnecting with the women in your life, what did you learn about Bloomington, about this place in the heartland that you ended up by exploring the Women of Bloomington?
You know, that's kind of an ongoing learning process. I think that what I found was that people come here for many, many reasons. They're typically connected to Indiana University. And, yeah, people do come here to work in the private sector, but for the most part, people come here to learn, and people come here to study, and people come here to research, and people come here to learn about the arts and to learn about literature and things of that nature. So again, in the middle of this, the heartland, the middle of this cornfield, there's this oasis, there's this community that's thriving with intellectuals and thriving with art and thriving with music and museums and libraries that are second to none in the world. And so I think the lesson that it's teaching me is that this is an ongoing process, and people come here because of the university.
Tell me a little bit about your actual process, even just thinking again about the Women of Bloomington exhibit. When you go to do a portrait of someone, what's the first thing you do?
Well, first thing I do is I meet with the subject and I meet with whoever I'm working with, because I want to get a sense of who that person is. I want to talk to them. I want to sketch them. I want to find out. In some cases, I want to go to their home. I want to see what their home is like. What's on their walls? What colors do they like? What colors are they dressed in? Because I think all that makes a statement about who you are. I look at the books on the bookshelf. I look at the CDs. Being a visual person, I look at everything. I look at the plants in these women's homes, if we're talking about the Women of Bloomington. So those are kind of the things, that those visual signifiers, those little symbols that come to play. And then what I'll typically do is I'll work a sketch and then take that right to the canvas and then do what's called an underpainting. And an underpainting has to do with tones that I want to be underneath the tones that I'm going to layer on top of those. And it's kind of a term, I think, in painting that talks about different temperatures and different tones that I'm going to use, light tones, bright tones, dark tones, et cetera. So the initial phase is kind of like a detective. I'm investigating.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a doctor. I'm probing. I'm reading, trying to read symptoms and take those symptoms to another level. And that other level would be then to put that on canvas and start the actual work.
From here, what is it that you most want to learn next? You know, this has been a pretty quick process in some ways. You've been painting about 15 years now.
About, mm-hmm.
And what is it you want to learn most as you continue to grow in your painting and in your work as an artist?
I think what I'd like to learn most is about this universal commonness that we all share, that we all are seeking love and compassion, that we all want to be held and loved and cared for and care for folk, because there's so many things that divide us. You know, we got the war in Iraq and the terrorists. We're divided against the Jews or divided against the Palestinians. And so there's too many things, I think, in our life that divide us. And I think in my work, what I want to examine is the things that are common, the common threads. Now, with respect to being a person of color, I think the things that I'm in most hopes of exploring is the vastness, this richness, and this just human capacity that often gets confused for something else, sort of this primitivism, this exotic primitivism. But really, it's just our way of expressing feelings. You know, sometimes it's called soul, sometimes it's called other terms. But I want to examine that and kind of contextualize that, because it's no different than the soul that a Japanese person has when they communicate, or that an Irishman has when he's doing his thing. And it's expressed in a different way. So I think I want to hopefully connect these kinds of things and put them in perspective to show the humanness about us all. I'm very influenced by literature, too. I read a lot of books. And
what are you reading right now?
Right now I'm reading Nella Larsen's biography. And I don't know how I got on, because I love novels, but now I'm into this biography kind of groove. I just finished Rampasad's Ralph Ellison. Ralph Ellison is one of my huge heroes. Invisible Man is probably the most important book for me ever. So I like to go back and look at literature. I like Greek mythology. I like the classics, Melville. I like Dostoevsky. I like going back and looking at tragic comic events that happen in literature and in people's lives, because I think that's what gives us our connectivity, those tragic comic events, because we're all connected through the same kinds of things, both tragic and comic. Mm-hmm. And looking at those things, examining those things on broad spectrums, not just dealing with blacks or Negroes or Irish people or Africans or Brazilians, but looking that on a broad spectrum.
How do you explore that in painting? Is it form, style, context, content?
It's all of it. It's all of it, and it's also letting go, too, and not staying up here as much.
Not staying up in your head.
Yeah, not staying up in my head as much as it is letting letting this intuitive kind of thing happen. The creative process is a staggering and often inexplicable thing that it's a process. It's not an event. Let me say that. It's a process, not an event. It's unfolding. And if I become open enough to let that process unfold, I surprise myself. It's just like I said earlier, I blow my own mind mm-hmm. with things that unfold. But if I've got some ideas in my mind, if I got some notions that formulate the basic things or direction I want to go, that's usually a good thing. And then I just have to be open to let the paint kind of tell me what's going on.
Another quote that's described your work, and this is one of my favorite quotes from Paul Valery, and it was said about your work by Eileen Julian, that poetry is the hesitation between sound and sense. And that moment that happens there, can you talk a little bit about why you think she used that as a way of capturing or explaining your work and your process?
Well, Eileen is a heavyweight. I'm not going to presume that I know what she was referring to, but if I were to take a stab at it, I'd probably say that art has this ability to sort of transcend the language, and it's sensuous. Mm-hmm. It involves the senses. It involves the sight, sound, touch, feel. And so in between perhaps what we want to think about in terms of language describing the art and what that art really is and how it impacts our senses, there's this thing. And what that thing is I think what Eileen was looking at or maybe speaking about, that nuanced thing, that very, very subtle thing that's again, very, very, very difficult to describe. But she does it beautifully in that analogy, and yeah. I'm thankful to her for thinking of me in that way.
It's almost like that cast of light in a painting that you can't quite even explain how it gets there, but
right.
It's what makes it
right.
work. Tell me a little bit more about what you would like people to most know about you and your work. And it's hard. We're talking about this visual work. Here we are talking about it on radio so that, you know, you can't see your paintings behind you, though you could go to your website to find more out about it. But tell me a little bit about what you'd want something to know about the heart of your work.
Let me start up. When I was in Amsterdam and I was at the Van Gogh Museum, I saw pain. I saw a lot of pain in Van Gogh's work. When I was in Germany and I saw Kirchner up close, I saw pain. When I saw Max Beckmann's work there, I saw a lot of pain. When I went to New Mexico and I saw George O'Keefe, I saw pain, but I saw something else. I saw beauty. And so I think that there's this sort of pain and beauty and this comic tragic, this joy and hardship or sort of thing that exists all the time in life. I just talked to a friend yesterday whose ex-wife had passed away at 50 years old. And he had a little baby born, all within a month span. And in wanting to be there to comfort him, I thought about, I guess, the answer to your question, that, you know, with hardship comes ease, you know, after difficulty comes ease. So I think that what I want people to see in my work or to come away with is a sense of the complexity of life. Life is complex, but it's simple. You know, there's these ideas that, you know, that are kind of hard to nail down in describing. But I want to show both this tragic comic aspect of life, how beautiful things are, but how ugly things can be too. And that there's beauty and ugly, and that there's ugly and beauty. And when I look back at the masters, when I look at Rembrandt, and when I look at Van Gogh, and I look at Putinari in Brazil, and I look at Cavalcanti, and Ibarre Camargo, or Diego Rivera, the Latin American masters, there was a lot of pain. There was a lot of struggle. And that's what I want to show in my work. I want to show that struggle is a part of life, but we can overcome that struggle with hard work and an idea. And I think that's perhaps revisiting that crossing is that this is a struggle. Life's a struggle. These musicians were struggling to bring this music to an unreceptive audience. And so I want to show what that struggle's about, hopefully.
Wayne, thanks so much for being with us on Profiles. Our guest has been Wayne Manns. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter. We're going to leave you with another piece of John Coltrane's. Wayne, what piece have you chosen?
I think we've got My Favorite Things, which is a Rodgers and Hammerstein composition that John Coltrane reinterpreted. And it's a kick in the pants kind of piece. It's a driving, hard kind of bebop-esque piece that was taken from a very famous musical. So My Favorite Things, I think, is the tune we're going to be listening to.
The program you just heard was recorded in October of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.